wants to say that I don't belong. He wants to say that you don't belong. But we are here to tell him we are America.
Yeah.
As Americans observe Black History Month, there is heated debate about what schools in the United States should teach about the contributions and experiences of African Americans.
We want education, not indoctrination.
This week, we ask, is Black history under threat? Also, the Smithsonian Museum is repatriating artifacts looted from West Africa during colonial times. Why does repatriation matter? Later in the show, my interview with the director of the Museum of African Art in Washington about reconciling the past and reframing the future. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome. I'm Heidi Adams, coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. February is Black History Month in the United States. It's a time to reflect and honor the contributions of African Americans to society, culture, and the history of the United States. For many, the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s was a game changer in the struggle for social justice, voting rights, and equality under the law. But what is the current state of civil rights in America? Are the advances of the movement enduring, or has the momentum stalled? VOA's correspondent Ignatius Arnold spoke to Americans about it here in Washington.
Thank you, Heidi. I'm currently at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Behind me is the edifice that houses more than 40,000 artifacts telling the story of African Americans here in the United States. Now, reactions from locals that I've been speaking to have been mixed. On one hand, some see progress that they say can be seen in the elections of non-white people in key government positions. They cited Vice President Kamala Harris and Ketanji Brown Jackson on the Supreme Court, for example. On the other hand, repeated calls for police reforms and the effort to tackle police brutality is what they say is retrogression from the gains that have been made in the past. Now, earlier, I spoke to a father and a daughter, Charlie Caswell and Tiara Caswell, from Memphis, Tennessee, at the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial here in Washington, D.C. Take a listen.
I think that we have made some gains, but yet that we still have a way to go. And I think that is because of the systems that have been put in place have not been truly eradicated. I think that when we look at where we are as a people, we have to come to the knowledge that when this country was formed, a lot of it was formed for a people that didn't look like us. And as we come to the knowledge of who we are, I think as we come together in a greater capacity, that change would then create a new system in which we are seeing gains in our community.
Since the civil rights movement, we've made some progress, but especially in past years, we're almost going backwards in a lot of ways, and we never kind of ever succeeded in equality in any means. So there's still a lot more progress to be made, and I think we're not seeing as much progression even since the 1960s.
Well, Black resistance to me means that we fought past our struggles, past our obstacles. We fought to really achieve higher heights, and we have so much further to go. And I think that Black people are now seeing that it's going to take us coming together. It's going to take us banding through some of our trials, some of our obstacles to really achieve the economic status that we're looking to achieve the educational status that we're looking to achieve.
I think that when former President Trump went into office, it awakened the beast of racism, and seemed to me that we didn't realize that there were that many people still involved in the racism. So I think we've gone backwards in that regard, but we're more aware today, so I think we're moving forward anyway.
I think you can't really erase anything in history. I think everything needs to be acknowledged, the good and the bad. I think for the sake of progress and for the sake of moving forward as a country of all races, I really think we need to acknowledge what happened in the past between races, and I think that it's important to not only acknowledge what happened, but also celebrate all of the cultural progressions that African Americans have made in this country.
Well, that's Ignatius Annold doing some great reporting for us here on Straight Talk Africa. Ignatius, thank you. Now, Black History Month comes amid a heated debate on how American schools are teaching black history or whether it should be taught at all. 13 states now have laws and directives restricting the teaching of black history. In the state of Florida, a specific course in African American studies is under scrutiny. The course allows students to receive credit and advanced placement at many colleges across the United States. Florida's governor, Ron DeSantis, opposes the curriculum, which he likens to political indoctrination. His critics, however, find his approach deeply problematic.
In the state of Florida, our education standards not only don't prevent, but they require teaching black history, all the important things that's part of our core curriculum. This was a separate course on top of that for advanced placement credit. And the issue is we have guidelines and standards in Florida. We want education, not indoctrination. If you fall on the side of indoctrination, we're going to decline. If it's education, then we will do.
Ron DeSantis has clearly demonstrated that he wants to dictate whose story does and doesn't belong. Mm-hmm. He wants to control what our kids can learn based on politics and not sound policy. He wants to say that I don't belong. He wants to say that you don't belong, whose story does and doesn't get to count. But we are here to tell him we are America.
And so that brings us to our question, is black history under threat in America? To help us understand what is going on, Calvin Dogg joins me here in studio. He's the co-founder and president of RC Communications. Calvin, once again, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Thanks for coming in to talk to us and help us understand what exactly is going on here. You know, this issue has really piqued my interest, especially as an immigrant to this country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got much of my schooling under South Africa's apartheid system. So I have my fair share of toxic levels of indoctrination and, you know, propaganda. And Calvin, I have a deep understanding of what it is to have your history either misrepresented or mm-hmm. just missing altogether. I mean, you just don't get that back. So what is it about this particular course on African-American history, which students, by the way, are not forced to take, mm-hmm. are they? But what makes this such a hot-button subject?
First of all, I am extremely thankful that I grew up around parents, and because they were a little bit older, I grew up around my great-aunts, my Aunt Naomi in particular, whose grandparents were enslaved. And, you know, she didn't die until 2006. I was here in D.C. until then. I grew up hearing this history and having that education that I didn't always get in school. And so for me, it's very important because it wasn't until I got out of North Carolina that I realized not everybody had that. Now, when it comes to what we're dealing with now, the most unfortunate thing is some of the biggest issues that we're dealing with in our culture and our society are rooted because people don't understand why they are the way they are, why there are laws that are in place, what the reaction to those laws is, because we don't teach it. And so, ironically, the people who are trying to stand in the way of teaching it, saying somehow that it helps children not be offended or feel as if they're responsible, it pushes back the date to when we can know it, understand it, and then move away from it. And so it is under attack, a lot of the black history that should be taught in our schools. The unfortunate part is if we continue to fight it, those issues don't go away until we address it.
And no country has a pretty history. I mean, right. The ugliness of the past is part and parcel of every country's history. I like what that young man said earlier, that we shouldn't exclude any part of the right. country's history. But let me get this straight. So students in America can take advanced placement courses for European studies, Latin mm-hmm. American studies, Chinese language and culture. Are these courses under fire too, or is it just black history?
It's Black history, and it's because of those unresolved issues. And one of the other reasons is when we think about history, too often the word carries centuries with it, just because we think it being so long. I try to remind friends of mine, colleagues of mine, that my parents, you know, when they got married, they all went to segregated schools. The Voting Rights Act hadn't even taken place the first time my parents were able to vote after they got married. My high school where I went was integrated 9 years before I was born, okay? So we're not talking about history that is so far off that the people who were affected, I mean, they're still living. A lot of them are in Congress. And think about the generation after them, like myself. So I think that's why it's such a sensitive subject, because it really forces us to deal with a painful part of our history that people are still dealing with in their own lives. And I think that's why you don't see the same backlash against some of the other topics that students can and, you know, and should take.
And, you know, 100 years even is a short time in the history of a country, of course, and we often forget that because the imagery comes in black and white often, but right. We forget it's not that many generations ago. Now, this is, of course, all part of a national debate about which part of America's history should or which parts should be taught in schools. Who's driving the other side of this debate, and what is their argument? You mentioned earlier about not offending people and making people feel uncomfortable. History is uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons, first is ignorance, because I think if you look at a lot of the people who are fighting this fight, if you look at Governor Ron DeSantis, for example, he's in his 40s. You know, this isn't as it isn't something that he had an authorship in 50, 60 years ago. However, because we haven't taught these things, there's a fear that if we broach these subjects, that people, institutions, ideas that we have will be under attack. So I think that's one of the main reasons. The other is that we have so many issues that are intractable, where I don't even know all of the solutions, whether it's police brutality in African-American communities, our fight for voting rights. We still have poverty that's based in an economic system that used a lot of the things that we're not teaching people about, like redlining, like Jim Crow and all of this. And I think that some people, it comes from racism for some. But I think for others, they realize that once you open this box, we've now got to tackle things that are more than history. We have to tackle things like who can get mortgages? Why do people live where they live? Why do we have laws with policing that are causing the situation we have now? And I think that's so scary for people that they would rather sweep it under the rug, or as my great aunt Naomi used to say, let the sleeping dogs lie. But the thing of it is they'll wake up one day. And so we need to deal with them as soon as we can.
I feel like your family members are right here at the table with us. I like that you invoke them. You know, I as a member of the African diaspora, I have visited the South. I've gone to Selma. I've done reporting there. And, you know, it's something you have to see firsthand in America. And that really, that experience taught me that in order to understand life today in this country, you cannot ignore that particular part of American history, because it will explain to you so much about why the society is the way it is. And I want to turn to the civil rights movement. Calvin, in your view, what does the movement look like today?
I think that a lot of the issue, we've made a lot of progress, okay? And it's a very kind of sensitive subject when people say, well, you know, when Barack Obama was elected, that was a milestone. It definitely was. I remember being in sixth grade, writing an essay about what I wanted to be. And at the time, I think I mentioned President of the United States. My teacher made me redo it, okay? Because she said, I need to be more realistic, okay? Now, my mom and daddy had an active conversation with that teacher afterwards, but I think that that was a milestone. However, milestones aren't the finish line, okay? A lot of the same things with voting rights we're still dealing with. A lot of the same issues with law enforcement we're still dealing with. So I think what people must understand, you can't let progress make you think that everything has been won. And if you admit that there's progress that has been done, that does admit that you are saying the fight is over. Okay? I think that we have made progress. There's still a lot to that needs to be done. And I think that some of these efforts at now closing the book on history are obstacles to that.
Mm-hmm. I saw a headline recently in the Chicago Reporter, and it really grabbed me. And it said, nearly 50 years after the civil rights movement, why is equality still a question? Why is it still a question in this country where there is so much and should be more than enough for everybody?
I think that it's a very valid question. You know, academia in schools, be it from elementary, high school, to college, to graduate schools, those are the kind of conversations that need to happen there. Because then you have those people that study it and come up with solutions. And then those solutions then filter out to public policymakers. And then we vote on them. That's a process. But if you cut off even studying those, that's why we're not having the discussions that we need to have. Also, I think what we need to realize is our society looks a lot different than it did 50 years ago, okay? It's not just black and white, okay? You have a lot of people who are immigrants who aren't black or white. I remember when I was in school in North Carolina, we have a huge Latino population. A good friend of mine in fifth grade said, I'm not black or white, which box do I fit into, okay? That's something that a lot of people are thinking about now. To address those issues of what it means to be an American, what it means to be equal, we've got to start at the root. Because guess what? Not only do we have to solve this for black and white people, we've got to solve this for all of the other races and ethnicities and mixtures of those that are now here that maybe weren't in their numbers 50 years ago, who have a place here and deserve to be here. We can't address those issues, though, until we address the root issues of our dysfunction over equality.
I wish we could have continued that conversation because that always interests me a lot. As an immigrant who is mixed race, who is from Africa, I'm very curious and always very interested to see the racial dynamics in this country that predominantly play out between black and white. But we understand what the history is there, mm-hmm. but that America looks different now and a lot of things change along those lines. But we'll have that conversation
again. And
we're
the same color.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I change colors, Calvin. So, but thank you so much for coming in and thank you for helping us understand what exactly this debate is about. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Calvin is the president and co-founder of RC Communications. Always great to have him here with us. After the break, we'll take you to the National Museum of African Art here in Washington. Now, the museum has given back nearly 24 stolen African artifacts to Nigeria. We'll discuss why repatriation matters and what's next for the museum walls where the famous Benin bronzes used to be. Stay with us.
Medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
The Benin bronzes, mired in controversy for more than a century, have been displayed in museums worldwide. I'm talking about thousands of treasures stolen from the Kingdom of Benin in present-day Nigeria by British troops during colonial times. Since the 1930s, Africans have campaigned for these artworks to be returned. And for decades, some of those Benin bronzes were on display right here in Washington at the Smithsonian's National Museum
for African art. The Smithsonian has now joined European museums in repatriating some of the looted artifacts from their collections. I visited the museum to find out if their repatriation could change the way African art is acquired and exhibited in future. The Smithsonian Institution is one of the biggest cultural organizations in the world. The repatriation of the Benin bronzes is part of the institution's so-called New Ethical Returns Policy. Nairi Blankenberg is the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African Art. I asked her how stolen African art can end up in museums like hers in the first place.
The process for how objects end up in a museum vary depending on the museum. So because the Americans didn't have a colonial presence at the time in the U.S., we were not a part of the process of removal, per se. I mean, it was for the Benin bronzes, it was 1897. It was a British expedition, that's quite clear. But what often happens is things that are removed, they make their way into the market, the art market. And then they are acquired through various people. And so through collectors, through traders, through diplomats, through missionaries, etc. And then often those things are gifted to a museum or donated to a museum. So our bronzes came from many different routes. They were all gifted to us. Some were inherited from other collections. And so they made their way into our collection and at different times, since the 70s and the 80s, I think even as early as the 90s, and they found themselves in our collection.
So can you give us an idea of what has been returned, what still needs to be returned, and what won't physically be returned to Nigeria in this case?
I think the really important thing about the restitution issue is the transfer of ownership. Because what that does is that changes who has the power to decide what happens to these works. And the people who decide may not always want them back, per se, but it's up to them. So in this particular case, we physically have returned 22 of the 29, and we've kept 27 on long-term loan, the terms of which have been dictated by our partners in Nigeria who own the work. We've also signed a memorandum of understanding with the Nigerian Commission of Museums and Monuments, and we're busy right now working with the Benin Museum on a collaborative exhibition that will have the Benin bronzes in dialogue with contemporary works, contemporary design in Nigeria and here. So it's definitely not the last time people will see the work here, but the terms through which we discuss these become more like other works of art. I think people get alarmed about restitution as this idea that someone's gain is someone's loss. And that's not always the case. I mean, museums everywhere have loan objects. There's an exchange of loan works of art. Most big temporary exhibitions have one or two works of art on loan in it. They're not always from someone's permanent collection. So I think the idea of transfer of ownership is really about the power to decide. It doesn't necessarily mean that no one, the members of the public in D.C., are never going to be able to see them again. That's not true. The terms, though, have changed.
And that is another question that I had. How do you feel about the fact that some of these artifacts will no longer be here? Is that bittersweet? Do you feel like it is a loss?
No, I feel great. I think that the work that we have here unethically or through violent conquest is unhappy, quite frankly. And I don't think it feels good. I don't think it's spiritually good to have stolen work or work that is only for ritualistic purposes or sacred work taken out of context and put into a situation where it doesn't belong. And so I'm absolutely happy about it. Listen, the Benin bronzes are exquisite works of art. And I'm very happy about this partnership and that we're continuing to make sure that they're seen by many people. But it's also super important that local people can see the masterpieces that have come from African cultures. I don't need to have a bunch of stolen loot or unethically procured things in my museum to be a legitimate place. I would rather create a space that Africans feel they belong, who don't feel stressed about coming here because they see evidence of our cultures as Africans, taken out of context, displayed in ways that are not meant to be, that go against the context or the intent of their creators. That to me is really stressful, and it's not right. And for me, that is a wrong, a historical wrong, that is far more important to rectify.
On these walls, visitors can see firsthand the writing of a wrong, 130 years in the making. Empty frames illustrate how many Africans may have felt about their heritage for so long, an emptiness that is only now being restored.
There have been calls for decades now, if not longer, for these items to be repatriated or for restitution to happen. What took the Smithsonian so long? Why now?
It's hard for me to say. I can't say with certainty that the request hasn't been made until now. I know that we have certainly had the bronzes for many years, and we've worked very closely with the Royal Palace in Benin City of Edo State for many, many years. And so it's not that we've been hiding that they're here. You can see here we've always acknowledged the circumstances under which they were removed. I think that perhaps it's a change in leadership. The Ethical Returns and Shared Stewardship Working Group was something that Secretary Lonnie Bunch and Undersecretary Coven Gover instituted before I came to the museum. So that was already underway. And I'm not sure kind of why or when, but I'm pretty sure it probably had something to do with when they were appointed as leaders. Coven Gover is a former director of the National Museum of the American Indian. And so, of course, issues of repatriation and restitutions are in the founding DNA of that museum. And Lonnie Bunch is the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And so definitely in his consciousness, the importance of ethical behavior for museums, particularly for African diasporic people, is front of mind. And then I joined in July, and as a South African myself, it's obviously a critical issue for me personally. And so I think it was really a confluence of perhaps leadership and also, I suppose growing consciousness in the museum community. I feel nervous saying that because I also don't want to dismiss the efforts that have been made through African governments and states and activists for decades around this issue. So I don't want to pretend that this is suddenly a new issue when it's not. People seem to be listening a little bit more now.
How does this process, though, affect what happens in future now? The way art is acquired, the way it is preserved, and the way it is exhibited. Will we see a change in that?
I hope so. I don't think necessarily, I'm not naive about the way the world works. You know, for us, the restitution was something we had to do in order to do what we really need to do, which is to become a 21st century global African art museum and a place for belonging and regeneration and resilience and joy for African peoples everywhere. And we can't do that when we have things that make people upset and when the work is upset itself. We can't do that. Our focus definitely is on the present and on the future. And to really moving forward to have more of a presence on the continent, a more intentional relationship with peoples from the continent, really recognizing the realities of the future, which is, we all say that Africa is the future. And that's, in the abstract, it's true. Demographically, that's true. For us, it's really important that become true on the day-to-day. And so that's African peoples, whether they're creators or visitors, feel that this is a space that holds them and that's for them.
And that story was filmed and produced by Karina Chowdhury. And the Benin Bronze's final destination is expected to be the Edo Museum of West African Art in Benin City, Nigeria, which is set to open in 2025. And that is where we will leave it for this week. Thank you for being with us. And of course, you can find us on Facebook at VOA Straight Talk Africa. And our Twitter handle is VOA Straight Talk. I will see you next time. Until then, thanks for watching. Goodbye.